It'll be first and 25.
This is First and 25, the Football Zebras podcast, our 25-minute roundtable discussion on officiating. This week, it's the full crew. I'm Ben Ostro. I'm joined by Mark Schultz, Cam Philippe, Chris Soiber, and Pat Weber. We have two rounds of the NFL playoffs in the books. We have the entire college football playoff in the books. We have a new national champion, a first-time national champion for the first time in quite a while. So let's just jump right in and get a few quick takes from our crew, and we'll start off with Mark.
In the playoffs, an interesting phenomenon happens when a team loses. They go back and look at the video of the game, and they see a 50-50 call that didn't go their way, or maybe a call that should have gone their way. And they plaster that all over social media, declaring that this is the reason why they lost the game. Well, you may have had a call go against you in the first quarter, but your opponent had a call go against them in the third quarter. It all evens out. And I know a losing playoff team does not want to hear this. They're going to call me a shill and a suck-up, but that's the way it is. And one simple call that might even be a 50-50 call is not the reason why you lost.
And yeah, we do get flooded quite a bit. And, you know, what about this? What about that? And then what it winds up being is it's everything. And so you try to dispel them all and you're just playing whack-a-mole. We saw something with a holding call that was not called. Why didn't you say anything about it? Well, it didn't look too terribly remarkable at the time, but, you know, looking at the video, okay, yeah, it's there, but no holding in the end zone, or at least that's not where the foul originates. So so no safety, and we're not pulling that out of, you know, some rabbit out of the hat after the game. So we went to that end where we had a couple of games that went into overtime, but then we had the other extreme. The Seahawks scored the game-winning touchdown on the opening kickoff. Pat, what did you see in that game?
Yeah, the Seahawks run it back and never looked back. And as the game went on, the score differential just got wider and wider and wider. And those are really not the playoff games that any official or anybody is hoping for when you get that assignment. But you still need to work all 60 minutes. And really, those can be the games where you really need to buckle down and lock in to make sure you're on top of it for all 60 minutes. I know we talked a few weeks ago about how in these types of games, usually some of the silly stuff takes care of itself because players aren't going to do that with the season on the line. But in these kind of playoff games, those silly things can creep back in if the officials aren't locked in on top of things.
And you add to the situation where you have the 49ers are decimated by injuries, and so they're trying to fight back. They've played the Seahawks, what, three times in 5 weeks? So, you know, it just keeps being this recurring situation and the recurring nightmare as it ends the season there. And then that frustration kind of creeps in, especially when you're down several injuries and you got people in there that aren't your starters and not in for very many reps. Chris, let's you know, we had a pretty much a smorgasbord of football the last month and a half, and tell us a little bit about what you saw between NFL and college football.
Selfishly, when I watch football, especially officiating, I like to try to understand what the professionals do, and the divergence that I noticed between what the college officials looked for and called during most of the playoff games, and specifically the championship game, versus how the NFL officials officiate, especially, for example, pass interference or whatnot, I thought they were almost two extremes of sort of the spectrum when it comes to calling, whether it's restrictions or whatnot, where the college officials, and My guess is they've been instructed because, you know, typically when officials work, they're told by their supervisor or whatnot, hey, this is what we want called. This is kind of what we don't want called. And it seemed like we kind of noticed this initially in the early games of the playoffs where, gee, there aren't very many flags being thrown. And at that time, it didn't look like there was a whole lot to throw. But in the championship game, there was a lot of grabbing and holding and what I consider to be clear restrictions that were not called. And if you juxtapose that to the NFL, where sometimes on Sundays we see a very small sort of grab the arm get called, it's just a surprising difference in my mind. And I think it might, maybe it's because, again, in the NFL, these athletes are the top of the world and any restriction impedes them from making a catch. But I just find it interesting, and trying to incorporate that into my Friday nights is difficult because you have those two extremes. And I don't know if everyone else kind of viewed that too, but that's kind of what I saw during this plethora of football this week.
Well, let me throw a little bit of an addition onto that. You have Miami, ACC, you have Indiana, you have a Big Ten, you have the officiating crew, Big 12, all different little fiefdoms of officiating, as it were. Well, first of all, I wouldn't think I'd work the word fiefdom into the podcast, but so you have different philosophy of different managerial styles and all that. So, I mean, Cam mentioned this with some of his regions up in Massachusetts for the playoffs and how there are some differing mechanics there sometimes. But here you have maybe Big 12 says, hey, we'll let that slide. And there might be an expectation in one of the other conferences is like, hey, you know what? We call those all the time. We're kind of expecting it.
Yeah, from my point of view, I agree. And when it comes to, like, again, Friday nights, and maybe Cam can jump in a little bit, they want us not to be the show. And I don't know if the college officials were told that as well. It's like, we don't want you to be part of this game unless you absolutely have to be. And maybe that took it a little bit to the extreme in our minds, but that clearly was the edict they got from on high going into these playoffs.
Yeah, I can attest that it's the same thing here. You don't want to insert yourself into a game, especially in a playoff game. And they always say make the Cadillac calls, and that's emphasized a lot more in the postseason. Again, I've talked in multiple episodes ad nauseum about the differing mechanics across different areas of the state. A problem here that I wish could be worked out. But yeah, in terms of the playoff games, you don't want to become the story, and I don't think anyone does at any level.
And we'll have a little bit more on the NFL side on things kind of in that realm there. But let me finish up with you, Cam. We had a little bit of unusual history there this weekend. We had Rusty Baines and Alan Baines both on the field at the same time. And that's pretty much a rare occurrence to have brothers out on the field in the playoff game.
It is a rare occurrence. And I can actually attest for all of us that at first we thought it actually was a typo in the list. So this is actually the fifth time, only the fifth time in NFL history that we've had brothers working on the field for a postseason game. The first time that happened was in Super Bowl 41 at the end of the 2006 season. Umpire Carl Paganelli and back judge Perry Paganelli worked together in that game. That was the first time it had ever happened. They ended up working two more playoff games together, one in 2008 and one in 2022, which happened to be Perry's final game. Referee Mike Carey and his brother back judge Don Carey worked a 2008 divisional game together. And this past weekend in Denver, the Baines brothers worked, and their father, Ron Baines, was also an official in the league. So this is a rare thing. They had only worked together once before in their entire careers. It was during the 2020 season where officials were working regionally. So, you know, you can imagine that was eventually probably going to happen since they both still live in the same general area in the southeastern United States, I believe. They worked a game in Tampa Bay back in 2020. But this is the second time they've worked together, and it was interesting that it was for a playoff game. Interesting also because Alan Baines had previously worked a wild card this year. So he worked a wild card in divisional. That is, I would argue, is even more rare. But as we've seen over the past 2 years, the playoff assigning protocols and techniques have been thrown out the window. And Vice President Officiating Ramon George is really putting in who he considers to be the best at each game, regardless of any of the old rules or patterns that were followed in past years.
And I just want to finish off with something interesting I saw. It was on the website Awful Announcing. They're putting out a thesis to retire the TV rules analysts. And I stepped back for a moment and I'm like, you can't do that. And I'm like, but I do see where they're coming from, which is anything that's in this gray area. It's like, well, what'd you think, Gene? What did you think, Terry? And first of all, I do think that there's a little bit, just a little bit of lazy broadcasting there when you just immediately punt it over to Gene's territory. I know Jim Nantz does that quite often, but you know, when you have an expert there, you tend to rely on them. The problem is they don't give them enough time to talk. And if there's a replay review, they go to commercial, they come back. It's like 10, 15 seconds you have to reset, tell them what happened. And from what we do here, which we really get deep in the weeds on some of the things, we'll give you a top line and then we'll sink down. And then, you know, I'll figure out that, you know, that people will be dispersing. And then, you know, by the time we get to the bottom of the post, there's about two or three readers left. But at the very least, we start off with some of that basic information and drill down to everything. Not enough time to get into that nuance. So they're like, well, what did you think? What do we have here, Dean? And then you hear silence because he knows he cannot fit any kind of explanation in that short span of time. So having them, like, you know, give a thumbs up, thumbs down on some of these replay reviews, that's not so good. And I think we could do away with it. But I do think that there's more time that could be spent on some of the little other nuances about the game, where we will put out something also in a limited space, character limited, in social media. And people say, oh, I didn't even realize that. I didn't realize that as soon as the kicking team possesses the ball, the clock doesn't even run at all. Or if the receiving team falls on it, they run 1 second. And so all of these little things that that should be part of it aren't. And the things of, you know, guessing, well, I think it is this, and then it comes back reverse. Well, okay. So you just kind of filled some time in that case. So I see what they're saying, but maybe there's a retasking of what that rules analyst role is. Let's jump into calls that we were looking at on the field and that there was plenty of analysis on. And so this is the specific thing that we would have needed more information on, process of the catch. We had very brief mentions on TV about what was going on with Brandon Cooks in the overtime. So he lost the ball and it wound up being an interception, not an incomplete, but an interception. Devontae Adams up over the middle, he surrenders the ball, but his is ruled down by contact. So everybody's flooding us with, oh, these are identical plays. They're not identical plays. They are similar plays. So I'll just open up the floor to anybody who wants to talk about what we've been talking about for the last 15 years or so, process of the catch.
I think one thing that people need to remember and sometimes gets lost in translation is for a catch to be completed, there are three distinct steps that have to be done in order. You have to have control. You have to have 2 feet or a body part down in bounds. And then after those two, you have to have your act common to the game or time enough to do so. You can't do those out of order. It has to be in that order. And there has to be that time element, which is the biggest difference, in my opinion, between those two plays is the time element.
And from a replay perspective, a lot of people were commenting on the fact that it was such a quick decision in the Denver game, the Cooks interception. You know, there's, especially now in the age of expedited review, there's no need for the referee to go all the way to the sideline if the call can be made very quickly. And the thing that they're looking for, we've talked about in the past, is not only if things are clear and obvious, but if there's smoke. So if the replay official is already looking at the play in the immediate aftermath, and there's nothing that's standing out to them that's going to be a clear and obvious, you know, people also like to say irrefutable, but clear and obvious is the standard. If they don't see anything that's clear and obvious that's going to result in an overturn, they're going to stick with it. And, you know, a lot of people complained that reviews were taking a long time and they were taking time away from the game, slowing down the momentum. And that's why expedited review now exists. So if they can do it and they're not able to see something clear and obvious, then keep the game moving. It's unfortunate when it happens in a playoff game in overtime, and it's a very critical play. But if this happened in the second quarter of a week four game, it would have been handled the exact same way.
And the other thing, too, is we've kind of alluded to the positives and negatives of replay on different plays. And when it comes to a time element, slow motion gives you a false sense of more time going by. Because the live sort of view of that Cooks interception was he was going to the ground, he hit the ground, and they kind of tumbled, and immediately he lost possession of the ball. Where if that ball just pops out and hits the ground, everyone is clearly going, that's incomplete. So the only difference here is there was a defender there that actually came up with the ball and then completed the process of the catch on his own. And, you know, internally, we did not see anything that jumped out to Cam's point of any smoke. And we were kind of surprised by the amount of sort of pushback on this. And as we tweeted, you know, after a Bills loss, there's more sort of requests for rule changes than anyone else. And I guess shout out to whoever took over Joe Burrow's Twitter account, because his first post since 2024 alluded to the fact that he didn't understand why everyone was complaining either, because he thought the officials banged both of those calls correctly, which was hilarious. And maybe he's a future sort of NFL official.
And one thing to remember, I just wanted to add, is because you got to understand the importance of the ruling on the field. And I want to give a shout out to back judge Scott Helverson. When that Brandon Cooks play happened, there was no hesitation. There was no calling in someone for another vantage point. He was signaling right away. He was giving the stop the clock signal, the waving arms, and pointing in the other direction for a change of possession. That was the ruling on the field right away. There was no hesitation that would have led someone to believe that there may have been something on the play that could be overturned in replay. So I just wanted to make sure I gave Scott Helverson, veteran back judge, a shout out there. He was able to see it right away, and replay wasn't able to see anything that went against what he saw.
And maybe the one takeaway is, Sean McDermott was complaining. Supposedly he took a timeout to give them more time to look at it, but they're like, hey, we're done. We've already moved on to the next play. We're very confident that we've looked at everything. There's nothing other than to delay things. And yeah, we're in overtime, and yes, we are going to start to overlap another game. That's not the overriding principle, but it's let's play football if we're very sure that we have this nailed down. So maybe there's a communication element, and just I'll throw out devil's advocate. You have a mixed crew, so maybe that whole communication element kind of broke down a little bit. Possibly you do have alternate officials that are also able to speak on these things. So, you know, maybe, you know, to reassure the coach, hey, they've already looked at it and they're confident. There's not going to be anything that's going to change with any amount of time. From that play, we go into what winds up being the final drive of that game, the game-winning drive by the Broncos. Well, I'll just go with what I wrote on the live blog here. Did the officials insert themselves into overtime? A fairly even tilt and not much to report throughout. But it's the change of possession and the ensuing final possession of the game that are under scrutiny, and whether the officiating changed. Quite simply, it did change, but not for the reasons that most would give. The officials can only officiate the game that's presented to them. The Bills became extra aggressive in the pass defense game, and the contact and restriction could not be ignored. Was it players that were gassed from having played a full game plus? Were they taking extra chances to leverage an advantage? Whatever it was, officials cannot pocket a flag when one team shifts out of four quarters of disciplined football into an extra period of pushing the envelope and then some.
And that hit the nail on the head, in my opinion. The teams are getting extra desperate in overtime, knowing one play could end the game, especially after both teams have possessed the ball. And the Bills were desperate to keep the Broncos from matriculating that ball down the field, and they were going to take chances. And again, the officials have to call the game that's presented to them, and they set this baseline for pass interference during the game. It stays the same in overtime, and then when they go, and then when they pass that threshold, they have to throw the flag. If they didn't throw the flag on that, it would have been a disservice to the officiating crew and a disservice to both teams.
And it goes back to what I had said before about if this were a week four game in the second quarter, if you plopped that same play into that scenario, would there be a different outcome? And I'm sure the answer would be no, because just looking at the play, even live, I was visiting family at the time, and I had just, you know, the officiating brain that I have, none of them have it, but I'm the one that has it. My first first thought in my head when I saw the play was, oh yeah, early contact, not playing the ball. And everyone's thinking, oh, you know, it's really, really tight, blah, blah, blah. No. It's early contact, not playing the ball. It's just because it's overtime in a playoff game doesn't make it not early contact, not playing the ball. So, again, Scott Helverson on that one too. Critical calls need to be made in critical situations and critical games. And, you know, I think it was there. That's my opinion, at least.
And Chris, you'll see the receiver and you're seeing one hand go up and not two. And it's like, well, he's not showboating. We know that.
Yeah, it goes back to kind of what we were saying was any restriction that, you know, doesn't allow the receiver to make an honest play on the ball has to be called. And that's an easy one to get. And I agree with Cam. Watching it was like, oh, yeah, that's pass interference. There's zero doubt in my mind that those are pass interference.
Yeah, I think consistency has become such a big part of officiating discourse. And consistency is extremely important, whether it's game to game, play to play, drive to drive, what have you. But I think some people get caught up in, if there's no fouls all game, that means inconsistent if there's any fouls late. When in reality, the consistency, as you said, Ben, is the baseline that's been set. And if the teams go beyond that baseline, that doesn't mean it's inconsistent when a flag comes out. And we don't want to be the story of the game. The officials don't want to be the story of the game. But that doesn't mean you can shirk the responsibility of the calls that have to be called in those big moments.
And you hear often NHL playoff overtime, officials will swallow the whistle. But again, I think that still comes down to, especially with hockey, where that margin is so, you make one mistake and puck's in the goal. And so in that situation, I could see more disciplined play happening until somebody, you know, does something to disrupt that. And in this case, the play of game, the amount, the defense that the Bills put on did change. It was not the same defense that they had used in regulation. And we're trying to be a little extra aggressive because, you know, now we were, what, three possessions in, and eventually something's going to give and it's going to end. So we have three more football games to watch and mull over, and three outstanding all-star crews. We can actually use the word all-star at this stage of the game. Alex Kemp is with the AFC Championship game. Clay Martin, NFC Championship game. Sean Smith, Super Bowl 60. All three of them are in the first games at those levels. Sean Smith has done a few conference championship games, but this is his first Super Bowl. So, we do have an all-star roster up there. What did you see?
I think one of the biggest takeaways is this is a little bit of a changing of the guard. This is the group that is going to be around for a while and names to keep an eye on to be in these games for a few years to come.
These three white hats are from the white hat class of 2018, where there was that mass exodus of four referees back in that time frame. Three of those four are getting the top three games of the year. And I'll throw in a shameless little plug. That fourth of four is the alternate referee for the Super Bowl, Sean Hockley. So exactly as Pat said, I consider it the new wave, and they're really pushing toward that new wave. And if you catch our episode next week, we'll dive into some more. You know, I love useless tidbits, and I've got a lot about the Super Bowl crew, but I'll give you a little cliffhanger for next week.
Ooh, a tease. I like that. And one more. So, you know, we have a couple of streaks, some records, all sorts of things to look at. And You know, this is where it counts. For Mark Schultz, Pat Weber, Cam Philippe, Chris Soiberg, I'm Ben Ostro. Thanks for listening to the First and 25 podcast, the divisional playoff edition, championship edition next week.